Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, June 23, 2015. Japanese mothballs, an easier alternative to bonsai. Kokedama is sometimes called poor man's bonsai, and the two do share some features. They're both small and displays of plants and moss. But lazy person's bonsai might be a better description, because it's far easier and less of a commitment, and you can find everything you need to make them at any home and garden store. Kokedama takes off from bonsai concept, said Kanako Yamada, who makes them at her business, Kodama Forest in San Diego. The difference is bonsai is usually for outdoors. They are brought in when a guest comes, but regularly they will be outside, Kokedama said. By contrast, we made to be enjoyed indoors all the time. Westernized Kokedama, which means mothballs, give this concept a few twists. One is that instead of just displaying them on pretty dishes, we're hanging them up. The other is that we're taking them outdoors as well. Basics couldn't be simpler. Put a plant in a ball of soil, wrap it in moss, and tie string around it. In Japan, Kokedama are made with bonsai soil, but that's not necessary or even a good idea in some climates. I have tried it and it works fine, but I didn't see a big difference, so I don't bother spending the money, said Lauren Hill, senior gardener at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. She uses about two-thirds potting soil and one-third another kind of soil, with more clay as a binding element, then adds water and adjusts the mix as necessary. You want to mix until you get the consistency of a meatball, she said. In Southern California, Yamada said that bonsai soil or any soil with too much clay will dry out too much. So she simply uses the soil the plant is potted in, adding peat moss as necessary. Another difference from the Japanese style is that instead of live moss, dried sheet moss is used, which you can buy packaged at craft and garden stores. Soak it in water and you get a green-brown sheet you can wrap. Don't confuse this with sphagnum moss, which is silvery gray and stringy and falls apart. The string that secures the moss around the ball can be purely functional or part of your design. I use regular twine, but I've seen it done with rubber bands, colored wire, basically anything you can wrap around the ball, said Hill. You can wrap a bunch of times so you can see it and add color or just enough to hold it in place. Kokedama should be hung in a way that's easy to take it down for watering because you'll need to soak the whole ball. Hill soaks them for 15 minutes or so and then lets them sit until they're not dripping. Outdoors, Kokedama shouldn't be in direct sun where they will dry out, and if you live in a cold climate, they'll need to come indoors for the winter. So choose plants with those factors in mind. We go for hardy plants that are tried and true, that in the summer we can handle being outdoors, then can come indoors and handle low light conditions, said Chad Washburn of the Naples Botanical Garden in Florida. He recommends plants such as philodendron, pothos, anthurium, and miniature orchids, and said one of my favorites is parlor palms. We can buy quite small ones relatively inexpensively, and they'll stay small in this setting. They do beautifully indoors and out. Plants that don't rely as much on getting moisture from the soil are particularly easy. Anything with that epiphytic growing style, things that naturally grow attached to bark and trees, those kinds of plants tolerate it really well because they naturally absorb moisture from the air, said Hill. Like any container plant, your Kokedama will eventually need repotting. Yamada said you can cut off the moss, prune the roots, and put new moss on. The same technique used in bonsai to keep the trees small, but she said after a few years she usually likes to move the plants to a pot and let it spread. Hill said that for many people, Kokedama may not be a long-term way to grow plants. In any case, I think that most people get impatient with how much watering they require, but for a summer or 6 months to a year, they're super fun to have around the house. Still, Kokedama provides some of the pleasures that Yamada learned about from her uncle, a bonsai artist in Japan who inspired her. He said in a small pot he can make a small forest and make people have a peaceful mind, a tranquil feeling, she said. I wanted to pass that on to people. St. Patrick adding art and religion to STEM to create STREAM. The third grade students at St. Patrick's School were given one task and no directions: build a water wheel. "We have added arts and religion to STEM," said Principal Jan Sweet, referring to the education acronym for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, subjects that are said to be crucial for this generation to master for career opportunities in the future. The final line is, "It's a way to teach students to problem solve. You give the students a problem and they have to solve it." Using rice instead of water so there wouldn't be the same degree of mess, the third graders used a variety of skills to draw, design, and build their water wheels. They had to work together and they had to learn to compromise, and that everyone's ideas were important. "Yes, this is louder than sitting in their seats listening to a lecture," Sweet said, "but it's active participation by every child. When kids are excited, they learn." St. Patrick teachers began using STREAM at every level from preschool through 8th grade in the last quarter of the year, and after seeing how well it worked for them, the staff attended a workshop to learn more about it after the last day of classes. The technology portion will roll out next year when every student from 2nd grade up will have the use of an iPad. The middle school students already have them. St. Patrick's staff is working with Illinois State University and will have further help in the coming year from ISU faculty member Brad Christensen and possibly some college students. Christensen plans several more visits and training sessions with the staff over the next several months. While STEM has become increasingly popular over the last 2 or 3 years in schools nationwide, St. Patrick's approach of adding a religion is a different twist, Christensen said. "The way we're doing that is we're drawing some of the context of math, science, and art from Scripture," he said. "If Moses led about 2 million people out of the desert during the Exodus, which is what scholars agree is about the size of the group, how much water did they need every day? About 80 rail cars. Students can take an idea like that, or the building of Solomon's Temple, and figure out all the details of engineering, math, science, and art, incorporating all those subject areas into one project, rather than learn the subjects first and do a project later." Christensen said students do the project first. "Education has historically been divided into disciplines," Christensen said, "and the more a person advanced in his chosen discipline, the more other subject areas were excluded. But that's not the way real life works, and it's not the most efficient way to learn, either. We think that by combining things together, it starts to make more sense, and students will be more engaged, more interested, enjoy learning more, and they'll understand it," Christensen said. "Preliminary research has shown that standardized test scores rise for students who have learned this way as well," he said. "It takes a year or two for the results to show, but project-based cross-discipline learning fosters actual understanding of concepts rather than memorization of facts and formulas. In this day of Google searches, it's even more critical for people to understand concepts rather than simply be what he calls storehouses of information, because the information is readily available. Sifting that information for accuracy and truth is the tricky part. It's a difficult shift for teachers who have long been trained to think of the perfect classroom as one in which the students sit at desks attentively taking notes while a teacher lectures. A STEM or STREAM classroom is one in which students are moving around, working together, and can look and sound somewhat chaotic. Teachers, too, have to learn and have to be able to ask leading questions, check on progress, and figure out if students are understanding, while simultaneously being able to back off and let the students do things themselves." So far, STREAM is a hit with students at St. Patrick. Third grade student Drake Hager-Long said he enjoyed the first project. "We did it together and we had fun," he said. "Students had to demonstrate their creations in action. Some worked well, some not so well. But that, too, is a learning experience," said student Nicholas Montaigne. "It was different," said student Jacob Atwater. "That was the fun part." Drug deal gone wrong leads to life-threatening gunshot wound, Decatur. A drug deal gone bad over narcotic mushrooms resulted in a Decatur man receiving a life-threatening gunshot wound, according to police. Sworn statements from detectives accused Richard L. Davis III of attempted murder Sunday night when he allegedly shot Benjamin R. Phillips through the torso. Phillips, 23, was taken to the hospital in the city and then transferred to Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana in critical condition with injuries described as serious. The statements claim Phillips had been out with a friend in Decatur on Sunday evening when the friend received a text from Davis asking if he wanted to buy any mushrooms. The friend said he did not, but Phillips said he was interested and a deal was arranged over the phone with the friend acting as a go-between. An agreement was reached on purchasing 1/8 of mushrooms for $40, according to police statements. But after the two men picked up the 20-year-old Davis in a car and drove to the 900 block of West Center Street to complete the deal, an argument broke out over the cost and amount of the drug involved, the friend told police. Mr. Davis III brandished silver-colored handgun attempted to rob Mr. Phillips. The statement quoted the friend as saying, Mr. Davis III and Mr. Phillips began physically fighting, and during the struggle, Mr. Phillips was shot. Phillips was driven to the hospital, and based on information from witnesses, police officers swarming into the area on a report of shots fired soon tracked down and arrested Davis. He allegedly admitted the drug deal, but said Phillips had been the one to start causing trouble. Davis stated during this transaction, Mr. Phillips refused to pay full price for the product and refused to return the product to him. Mr. Davis III stated Mr. Phillips produced a handgun and stated he was keeping both. Davis said he then brandished his own handgun, and as the altercation escalated, Phillips was shot with Davis's gun. Davis remains in custody at the Macon County Jail on Monday night in lieu of posting a $100,000 bond. He is due in court Monday, June 29th. Decatur man faces armed robbery charges. A Decatur man faces armed robbery charges after allegedly holding up another man while threatening him with one of the world's most powerful handguns. Sworn police statements said Derek M. Leonard, 35, committed the robbery June 3rd and was caught 3 days later after a foot chase when he fled from police after a traffic stop in the 400 block of West Green Street. Police say they found a Desert Eagle brand 50 caliber gun in the vehicle, the same gun allegedly used in the June 3rd robbery of a 50-year-old man as he walked home in 300 block of East Center Street. The victim told police he had encountered Leonard earlier that day in a market and had tried to sell the alleged robber some hygiene products, which Leonard had refused. He said Leonard had later pulled up near him in an SUV and beckoned him over before threatening him with a weapon. He advised Leonard, stated something similar in nature, to give me everything while pointing to the handgun at the victim's head, the sworn statement said. Out of fear for his life's safety, he complied and provided Leonard with his backpack, which contained hygiene products, a cellular telephone, an external speaker for the cellular telephone, and a necklace. Police say the robbery victim later picked Leonard out of a photo lineup and identified him as the man who robbed him. Leonard remained in the Macon County Jail on Monday night in lieu of posting $250,000 bond. He also faces charges of being an armed habitual criminal. Doctors use mannequin to trace Lisa Cutler's wounds. To demonstrate the number of injuries Lisa Cutler suffered throughout her body, prosecutors brought in a department store mannequin and asked the pathologist who performed her autopsy to place a marker at each wound. After Associate Judge James Coriel suggested identifying each injury with a letter, Dr. Amanda Yeomans placed 6 stickers on the mannequin's head, 8 in the vicinity of its elbows, 2 on the hips, and 1 on the left ankle. Yeomans said the letters A through Q in the Monday morning session to help prosecutors drive home their point that the defense theory of accidental death was not credible. Another pathologist, Dr. Scott Denton, who performed an additional examination of the victim's body 3 days later, added 6 more stickers to the dummy in the afternoon session, R through W. A total of 23 wounds were identified altogether, which the doctors both said occurred about the time of death or a short time earlier. Denton explained that after the blood is removed from the body during an autopsy, the skin becomes pale and white, causing bruises to subsequently stand out more for easier identification. On the sixth day of the trial, Chad M. Cutler, 39, charged with first-degree murder for the drowning death of his 47-year-old wife. Yeomans and Denton became the third and fourth expert witnesses to testify that Lisa Cutler's death was no accident. Two expert in aquatic deaths testified during the first week. Additional witnesses Monday included a forensic scientist who testified DNA found under the victim's fingernails was a high-probability match with Cutler's. A crime scene investigator who photographed scratches found on Cutler's arm and acquaintances who heard her stories of abuse and death threats. Yeomans, who performed the autopsy April 27, 2012, nearly 9 hours after Lisa Cutler was pronounced dead, said the cause of the head injuries was blunt force trauma. She said Lisa Cutler was 5'4" tall and weighed 120 pounds. At that time, Chad Cutler was 5'11" tall, weighing 210 pounds, according to a court document. Under examination by First Assistant State's Attorney Nicole Kroenke, Yeoman said the injury to Lisa Cutler's head, bruises to her scalp, and an abrasion to her forehead were consistent with an assailant holding her head underwater with both hands. The bruises to her elbows and forearms were consistent with a victim pushing her elbows against a bathtub wall as she struggled for breath. In response to a question on the manner of death, Yeoman said, "My opinion would be a homicide." Under cross-examination by defense attorney Jeff Justice, Yeoman said the fact that the victim's hands and feet were not wrinkled was inconsistent with someone submerged in water for a long period of time. Chad Cutler told police and acquaintances that he went to bed about 10 p.m. on April 26, 2012, then discovered Lisa submerged in her bathtub, in their bathtub 3 hours later. Cutler sat at the defense table taking notes and consulting with his attorney as the doctors placed one sticker after another on the mannequin. Just behind the mannequin was the bathtub where his wife drowned. It has been sitting on the defendant's side of the courtroom near the judge's bench throughout the trial. Yeomans acknowledged she could not describe in detail how the victim drowned, but asserted that an external force on her body forced her into the water. Under questioning by Justice, Yeomans said he could confidently place the time of the bruises as shortly before her death, because the color of the bruises showed the tissue had not had time to begin the healing process. Denton testified he became involved in the case when state police investigators asked for an additional examination of the body on April 30, 2012. The additional bruises that appeared at that time were found on the backs of both hands, two on or near the left knee, one on the right knee, and one on the back of the left ring finger. The extensive bruising to the elbow areas was caused by the elbow striking something hard or something hard striking the elbow, she said. He said, "The injuries were consistent with striking the side of the bathtub while she was trying to escape," Denton testified. Adrienne Bird, clinical social worker, testified that she spoke with Lisa Cutler on five occasions from October 2011 to February 9, 2012. On January 12th, Lisa Cutler told her that things at her home were getting worse. Chad had become more angry, more violent, Bird said. She came home and he had thrown some of her belongings in a pond behind her house. She was really worried. She was fearful, very anxious. She was afraid he was going to snap and kill her. Tonya Melhorn, a former student who served as Lisa Cutler's hairdresser, testified that whenever Lisa confided in her about how her husband would drink and get violent, she would shake. She said she was afraid he would go too far, Melhorn said, adding that the last time she came in during August 2011, she said the situation had not improved. Two colleagues at Eisenhower High School, where Lisa Cutler worked until her death, said she had just begun to express hope for a better life. Science teacher Timothy Murray said he noticed a change in her about 10 days before her death. That day she was beaming, she was smiling, Murray recalled. When he asked her why she was looking so good, she told him she had met a man who had gone with a date, you might say. He told her to be careful until she got her divorce. She told him it was platonic. She really enjoyed being treated like a lady, Murray said. Carolyn Slifer, a former Eisenhower teacher, was working as a regular substitute teacher with a room across the hall from Cutler's in April 2012. When she saw Lisa Cutler in the hall on April 26, she was cheerful, upbeat. Prior to that, she mostly seemed depressed, Slifer testified. Cutler, who she considered to be her friend, told her, "I have exciting news to tell you." Later in that conversation, Cutler said, "I have decided I am going to get a divorce. It is going to be the best thing to happen for me and my children." Attorney John Erickson testified he was retained by Lisa Cutler for her divorce and order of protection. He said he received a message from her on April 23rd, and she wanted to proceed with her divorce. After he did not speak with her in the following days, she left two more messages. A voicemail message was left for Erickson after 3:30 p.m. April 26th. She again insisted it was important for her to proceed with the divorce case, Erickson said. She died later that evening, Kroenke asked. Erickson said that she did. Rauner puts new veterans home in budget crossfire. Springfield. Among the more than $820 million in budget cuts being threatened by Governor Bruce Rauner is one that would delay the opening of a new nursing home for veterans. But records and budget documents show the $70.2 million project wasn't expected to be open for more than a year anyway, raising questions about what exactly would be saved. On June 12th, Rauner unveiled a laundry list of projects and programs that could be suspended or delayed until on July 1st because of the budget impasse between the Republican chief executive and Democrats who control the General Assembly. Among them was an under-construction veterans nursing home in Chicago. Rauner said the cuts are necessary because the budget approved by the legislature would spend billions of dollars more than the state is expected to receive in the fiscal year beginning July 1st. While Democrats say the state needs more revenue to fill in the gap, Rauner says he won't sign off on any tax hike unless the General Assembly approves parts of its business-friendly agenda. Lindsay Walters, spokeswoman for the Illinois Capital Development Board, which is overseeing the construction of the 200-bed home, said the opening would be delayed 6 months until January 1, 2017, saving $4 million. Rauner's original budget plan, however, shows no evidence of the facility opening before July 1, 2016, which is the next fiscal year, and thus not affected by the current budget battle. There are no line items in the state's proposed operating budget showing earmarks to pay for furnishings or the hiring of additional workers. Based on operating ratios at other state veterans' homes, an estimated 150 to 170 workers would be needed to operate the facility. Ryan Yanta, spokesman for the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, said the $4 million in savings are startup costs. There is no need to hire staff until late 2016 to train up and certify prior to opening for resident admissions, Yanta said in an email. Furnishing and outfitting are planned for the late 2016. It is also not clear whether delaying construction on the five-story facility will affect $45.8 million in federal funding that is helping to pay for construction. Democratic Senator John Mulroe, who represents the district where the facility is being built, said he opposes using programs affecting veterans as bargaining chips in the fight over the budget. "That's not something we should mess with," Mulroe said. Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick, who also represents the district where the facility is under construction, agreed. "It's just ridiculous," Martwick said. State Representative Jerry Costello, Democrat Smithton, a ranking member of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, decried the threatened delay, saying the savings don't match up with the need. "This veterans home will benefit numerous servicemen and women, and delaying its opening as a negotiating tactic speaks for itself," Costello said. The state currently has veterans nursing homes in Anna, LaSalle, Mantino, and Quincy. The biggest state veterans home is in Quincy with an estimated 550 residents and a budget of more than $47 million. The smallest home is in Anna with 70 residents and a budget of about $3.8 million. Yoga helps kids learn about fitness at Camp Connections, Decatur. "If there's one thing that says superhero, it's strength. We do yoga for our muscles," said Anaya White, 6, flexing her biceps. Camp Connections is all about heroes this summer, and though the kids started off with familiar Batman and Superman sort of hero, they've been learning about that heroes come in all shapes and sizes. They can even be heroes themselves. At the Baum School site, yoga is a regular part of the young heroes' activities. Heroes need to take care of their health, said Counselor Lisa Ferriozzi, and every day includes active play and lessons in human nutrition, in healthy nutrition. We've already had a busy day, she said with a laugh. They've been to the Y, they've played dodgeball, and in a little while we have PE. Yoga videos are available online at CosmicKids.com, led by Jaime Amer, whose soft voice and lifting British accent are soothing. Behind her, thanks to green screen technology, lives an animated world of stick bugs and caterpillars, rainbows and butterflies, while she tells stories and teaches kids to do yoga and poses that go with action in the stories. The videos are available for free, and Lamone Triona Turner, 7, says she does them at home, too. I just like it, she said. I think it's fun. The Amers met thanks to Jamie's work teaching yoga to children in England. She is a trained actor who studied at Bristol Old Vic, and between acting gigs, she entertained at children's parties. She is also a certified yoga instructor, and their website releases a new video every month, as well as DVDs for home use. Both kids and adults take part, though the kids do a little more squirming and the adults can't always contort their bodies into a position where, to use one of Jamie Ammer's examples on Monday, they can pretend to use their foot as a phone, although the attempt ended in helpless laughter. Yoga relaxes them and calms them down, Ferriozzi said. This has been Mary Mortland reading part one of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015. We will begin shortly with part two and the obituaries.